This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security has an expansive and varied mission. Managing its resources efficiently, effectively, and as one DHS are key to it successfully meeting that mission. How is the Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is DHS doing to better manage its resources and execute its overall mission? How is DHS providing balanced stewardship between meeting mission objectives and investing wisely? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Rafael Boras, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Rafael, welcome.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser. George, welcome. Rafael, let's start off by learning more about the department. Though our listeners are very familiar with the Department of Homeland Security in the midst of its seventh year, perhaps you can give us a sense of the mission and its continuing evolution.
Well, let's start with the QHSR. I think that's a good place to start because that was a sort of a seminal moment for the department where it was able to finally come to grips with its core mission. For any organization, come to grips with what the core mission is. What do I want to be when I grow up? Getting to that point is important because it's from that basic notion of who are we and what do we want to do, and from that flows your programs, your activities, your mission. So it was very important to get that right. Giving us a framework to be able to operate is the key, and it's the same thing in management. You know, I think it's very important to start with a sort of a conceptual framework. What is it we're trying to achieve? How do we want to do it? What do we expect? What are our outcomes? And how are we going to measure that? And that's what the QHSR and the BRRR give the department, an ability to begin that process. So it's good.
So with an important mission that the DHS has, could you give us a sense of operationally, what's the size and scale of its operation? What's the size of its budget, number of FTEs, and the geographical footprint of the department?
We're everywhere. All you have to do is watch the news every day, and we probably dominate half of the news on any given news day. We're roughly 200,000 employees. We have a operating budget of around $43 billion. That's appropriated dollars, and we have a lot of fee-generating activities, which bring us up to about $53, $55 billion. You know, it was very important for the department in order to come together to find that identity. Think about it. You had 22 different components that came together from different agencies, all with their own legacy notion of what they were, who they were, what their mission was, oftentimes connected to completely different mission sets. So if I came from the Department of Transportation or I came from Treasury, had a different context in which I operated my business. And coming into the Department of Homeland Security, where we were the mission of securing the borders, aviation security, safe and resiliency, those are very, very different notions. And weaving that together, creating a fabric, bringing it all that together, really required a different mindset. So, you know, we're only 7.5 years old, really approaching 8 years old. I liken it to, you know, with the raising of a child. You know, if you raise a child without any guidance, without any structure, God help you by the time that child becomes a teenager, and then you say, you know, put your shoes on before you go outside or comb your hair, they typically say no. And that's what we were trying to get to at this department. We need an identity. We need a structure. We need a way and a platform to be able to do our business.
So with an important mission, a varied mission, and a huge operational footprint, let me talk a little bit about what you do as the Undersecretary for Management for DHS. Could you give us a sense of the role and the responsibilities you have under your purview?
Probably the simplest way to describe it is the Undersecretary for Management is the Chief Management Officer for the agency. So what does that mean? In addition to all of the financial apparatus, the human capital apparatus. So it's the CIO, the CX, all the chief financial officer, the chief procurement officer, all of those administrative authorities report to the Undersecretary of Management. But I really think about my job as being sort of the number one steward for good government. Really, that's what I see my job is, to constantly talk about good business practices, good return on investment. Now, somebody's going to say, what investments in the federal government? Well, we make investments in people. We make investments in goods and services that we acquire. So it's my job to make sure that we're good stewards of those investments, of the taxpayers' money. So I'm always talking about good government. I think that's my job.
Yeah. How do you support, or how do the functional areas that report through you support the overall mission of DHS? And specifically, I think you mentioned the 22 different components that make up this rather large organization.
That's done largely in an integrated fashion. You know, we serve basically two primary functions. We have sort of the headquarters or the departmental level responsibility, where we have to be good stewards of the department's overall business. And then we are a service function. We have to serve the component agencies that are meeting the mission of the department. And that oftentimes is the area that gets the least amount of attention. So we often talk about in management, what do we do to comply? And I'm trying to change that conversation. What are we doing to serve? So how are we serving the component agencies? That's very important to me.
As you look at both the compliance and serving the component agencies, you know, it's probably endless opportunities for things to do. When you look out, what were the three most important things that you needed to work on when you came aboard, and how are you working on those three items?
You know, I identified essentially three major areas of attention. I think it's very important coming into an organization to provide some context, a framework for what you're going to be focused on. People want to know that. So I've tried to distill that down to some very simple notions. We're going to concentrate on very strong financial management, and I'll get back to each one of these. We're going to concentrate on good acquisition, and then finally we're going to concentrate on our people, our human capital. Really, those are the pillars. Those are the foundation that we're going to build our success upon. So for financial management, it's not just, again, complying with what we have to do financially, the requirements we have to report to OMB, to report to Congress. Are we doing the right kind of analysis, the right value-added analysis to help decision-makers make good decisions? Now, when I look at the Department of Homeland Security, like many other federal agencies, one tool that's lacking that clearly in many areas in the private sector, we have these tools, and what I call decision support tools. But do we have the tools that inform decision makers? You know, the department is very large. We have a very varied mission. We execute that mission through hundreds of thousands of employees, along with not quite an equal number of contract employees. So there's a lot of people executing the mission. In addition, we work with our state and local partners. So it's a vast array of people that are involved in the mission of DHS. One of the things that's lacking at the Department of Homeland Security, but we're doing something about, is beginning to get a grips with what's the right kind of information we need for decision makers, how are we going to collect that information, how we're going to provide it to decision makers real time so that we can make better, smarter decisions. Now, those tools don't make the decisions for you, but they support decision making. The business of protecting the nation's homeland requires real-time support. So while I am not in the frontline provision of service business providing Homeland Security services, we are providing that backbone support, and I need better tools to be able to do that. So financial management is very, very key to that. You know, with all of these areas, the commonality is what I talk about quite often is getting back to the basics. Do you perform your core mission well? When I speak to young people in the department outside, I always get the same question from young folks. What can I do to get better? That's a question I'm always asked. What can I do to get better? Implying, what are the shortcuts I can take to get to the top? And I always answer the same way. And it's not just to young people. I say the same thing within the organization. If you want to get better, you've got to get good first. So In that human capital area, when we're talking about how do we train and develop our workforce and getting back to those core skills, is if you're in the financial management area, make sure you're good at what you do. And we need to make sure that we're providing you the tools you need to be able to work effectively and smart. Same thing with acquisition in human capital, in information management, all the areas. So it's a big sort of back to the future movement. I want people to get good at the basics, be good at their core skills, and then we can help them get better.
You know, leadership starts with a leader. So I'll ask you a little bit about what you were good at as you worked through your career in order to get where you are today.
Well, you know, I was very lucky in the beginning of my career. I started working in county government in the budget office. And I can't think of a better place for a young person to begin his or her career in government, any level of government, than as I had the opportunity to start my career in the county's budget office. It was like going into the brain central. It really was like being at the master control. Think of the Wizard of Oz. I got a chance to work behind the curtain and see how government worked. It was a tremendous education for me. And I stayed in local government. I did some other things, but I wound up going back to city government in the early 90s when I worked as a deputy city manager in two different cities. I got to tell you, that was really, really important foundationally for the evolution of my skill sets. Being in local government as opposed to the federal government, there's a tremendous sense of urgency. You have to solve problems right away. So if everything works well, you typically don't hear from folks, but that rarely happens. So if the garbage doesn't get picked up, you hear about it. If the schools are not open on time or if the facilities are not working correctly in the summertime, if the pools don't work, there's immediacy to action. That was a great discipline about getting things done. Also, in my case, and like many city governments, you work in the same space as a legislative body. So the city council, and in my case, the city manager's office, the mayor's office, were all located in City Hall. So you have that immediacy of somebody walking into your office and saying, what are we going to do about this problem? As I moved to the federal government in 94, when I went to the Commerce Department, I found that I had to learn a different pace to work. It is challenging in the federal government because you're so far removed, particularly in a role like mine, you're so far removed from the end user, that you really need to be self-disciplined about making sure that you keep front and center. What am I here to do? I'm here to serve and instill that into your organization. So all of these lessons, George, were very important in my foundation to help me build up to where I think I am today, not to mention my 10 years in the private sector was also very helpful.
I was going to ask you, how did the private sector experience either, help or influence your ability to serve in the public sector capacity?
That 10-year stint in the private sector was instrumental in allowing me to learn how to think about the value proposition of what I do. Very, very important. You know, at the end of the day, when you're in the business of selling professional services, whatever they are, I happen to be in engineering construction industry, but it could apply to any. You have to add value, otherwise your client doesn't need you. So it was that need to understand what were the client's needs to be able to fulfill them, and also to learn how to do that efficiently. There was no need to waste resources in the private sector. Everything that you waste is you're losing it from the bottom line. So that bottom line focus was very, very important, a great discipline. There's another commonality that I found in the private sector, along with local government, that we don't quite have in the federal government in most cases. And that's the attention to what I call the revenue side of the equation. In local government, you have to manage to your revenues. You're looking at your property tax revenues. You're looking at other receipts. And you're constantly watching, as I say, both sides of the ledger. Same thing in the private sector, certainly. You're looking at your revenue. You're looking at your cash flow. You're looking at your burn rate. You're looking at all of these things that go into how do we monitor and measure our business and be able to project. Well, in many areas of the federal government and other governmental units, we manage expenses without a lot of thought about either the return on investment on that expenditure or anything to bump up against, as I say, the other side of the ledger. So finding ways to instill that discipline in a largely expense-dominated financial culture is a challenge. And I do that with a lot of it with reporting, looking at information, trying to replicate a business balance sheet and creating that document, even though it's not a perfect document because we don't do that the same way in the federal government, but creating tools like that to allow people to look and think about the consequences of their action, the cost of certain activity, to think about overhead. It costs something to run programs. We don't often do a good job of stepping back and analyzing what is the cost, what is the right cost structure to support these kinds of activities.
Raphael, it's a great segue into understanding. You've alluded to it a little bit about the need to serve as an element, I would say, of leadership. But I want to get a sense of your definition. What are the characteristics of an effective leader? And who, if anyone, has influenced your leadership style and management approach?
Well, you know, there were so many individuals along the way, wonderful men and women that were mentors, both officially and unofficially, some who I work for and some from afar. And I took away so much from all of them. You know, I'll give you a very simple story. During college, I was working for my father, and my father had a business associate who was in a relatively comparable line of business as my father. And he walked into my father's business one day, and he said, I acquired a dozen crates of batteries, and I'm going to sell these batteries, and they're a great deal, and I'm going to make all this extra money off these batteries. And he had this conversation with my father, and he left, and my father said, he's going to wind up eating those batteries. And I had to be about 17 years old at the time. I said, Dad, I don't understand. What do you mean? He says, he's lost sight of what his business was. He just took advantage of this opportunity, took batteries in, and thought he was going to get in the battery business, and I predict he's going to wind up eating these batteries. Well, lo and behold, about a year later, my father got a call. This fellow was going out of business. And because he was in a related business to my father, he said, oh, you might want to come over and take a look at, you know, maybe there's some things that I've got that you can use. So my father asked me to go with him. And we looked at some of the tools, some of the merchandise that was my father didn't have any interest in. He took me into the back and he said, I want you to look at something. What do you see in front of you? And I stood staring at all these boxes and it didn't hit me right away. And my father said, there are all the batteries, case after case after case of batteries. You know, as simple as that sound, it was such an important lesson that I learned about, A, understanding your core business and staying to your core business. And I use that a lot for myself to make sure that I'm not getting myself into batteries.
What is the One DHS vision and strategy? We will ask Raphael Borras, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Raphael Borras, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser.
Raphael, roughly half the department's annual budget is spent on procurement and acquisition-related activities. Simply stated, acquisition management is a primary route for you to deliver the mission services. What are some of the critical challenges you're facing in this area? And tell us a little bit about what you're trying to do to enhance DHS's acquisition and procurement structure and the processes to meet these challenges.
Oh, George, I love the question because it gives me the opportunity to talk about one of the areas that I'm most excited about. And really what we're talking about is the department's overall acquisition strategy, our acquisition approach. Here is the best opportunity to maximize our return on investment. To be good stewards of the roughly $11, $13 billion annually we spend on acquisitions. So what makes a good acquisition? What is a good acquisition? It starts with, again, it's going to sound so fundamental. It starts with good requirements. You know, I look at the two opposite ends of the acquisition life cycle. You have to start off with good requirements. I've got to know what I want to buy, what I want to use it for, how do I intend to measure its effectiveness, what do I consider to be the life cycle or the lifespan of that investment. That's at the front end. Almost, you know, I don't want to diminish it. The procurement part is somewhat easy. You know, go put out an RFP that's based on a good set of requirements, make the best award you can, negotiate the best deal. And then the second phase or the second hardest part of this is managing the implementation of any acquisition. So those are the two areas that I am spending my time right now focused on quite a lot. How do we get better at defining requirements? I don't want to slow the process down. Again, so here's the challenge. We don't want to make it so cumbersome that it becomes so difficult to develop requirements that we'll never get anything out the door, that we won't be able to buy anything. So that wouldn't be a good use of our time. But how do we build in the appropriate gateposts, if you will, so that we're getting good requirements, we've got a good fundamental, good sound procurement strategy, we execute that, and then we have the ability to implement or execute the delivery of that. Those are the areas of acquisition that I'm most focused on. The good news is that my predecessors have built a good foundation on which to build on, development of some departmental regulations that allow us to do some of those things. All we're doing is building upon that, strengthening the front end and strengthening the, what I call the back end or the execution side. If you look at those programs in the department, those that have not gone as well have a commonality. They all started pretty much with poorly defined requirements and weren't executed optimally. So why focus on acquisition? Well, again, as you said at the outset, that's roughly half your spend on an annual basis. I want to put the maximum amount of energy into the maximum amount of effect that I can to maximize my resources. There's a lot of things that we can be doing, but we've chosen to concentrate on the acquisition because I think there's great efficiencies there to be had, both in terms of negotiating better contracts, getting better deals on behalf of the government, but also doing a better job on executing these programs and working with our partners in the private sector and the other sectors, because that's how we execute a lot of our business.
So, Raphael, what are you doing to drive results, outcomes, transparency, and accountability in your organization?
Well, we've been going through an exhaustive process. And I say exhaustive. Coming on the heels of the QHSR and the BRRRR, it was important to begin to turn our attention, our management attention, to what are the indices that we will measure to be able to showcase to the American people that we are indeed fulfilling what we stated in the QHSR and what we identified as priorities in the BRRRR. So we've been going through this very exhaustive process to develop performance measures that are realistic, that are reflective of the true mission of the department. This has been something that the Secretary, Secretary Napolitano, has been really, really pushing us to do. And I've got to give tremendous kudos to our Deputy Secretary for really helping drive this process. So we're literally going top to bottom through all of our performance measures. We've thrown out a whole bunch of them. We've come up with new ones. But it's forcing every component, every service delivery part of DHS to take a look at what is their core mission, how do they plan to do it, and how do you measure that? How do we know that we're delivering what we've said we're going to do? And you think about such a varied mission, whether it's the Coast Guard, how do we know that the Coast Guard is doing all it can, and how do you measure their effectiveness in search and rescue, for example, or in FEMA after an incident? How do we know that FEMA is actually doing a good job? Well, we got to understand what their job is first. There was a lot of issues surrounding Katrina and other events like that. We've learned a lot about what is the role of the federal government, how do we work with our state and local partners, and then force us to think, okay, how do we determine, how do we measure that effectiveness? How do we know we're doing a good job? How do we know we're doing a good job in aviation security? What is a good job for a job well done for a transportation security officer on the line, for example? You know, how do you look at that? How do you measure that? You know, these are the things that we've been working very hard for the last couple of months, and we have to complete that process. OMB has to review that. It's, again, a requirement internally before we can disseminate them. But I think the department has shown a lot of creativity, a lot of innovation, and really a determination to rethink how we should talk about what we do and then, therefore, how we measure that.
In addition to having great people, there's a huge expectation of you being leading the prudent stewardship of financial resources. And one of the things as DHS came together was you inherited the opportunity to have lots of financial systems and lots of financial reporting. How are you pulling all that together so that you can get, you know, timely, meaningful data pulled together, especially as you look at consolidating to a one DHS?
George, that's square one at building the new DHS. I alluded to earlier, the need for decision support tools or business information tools to enable decision makers to make better decisions. But fundamental, we need good financial management systems that provide the data and then support and feed these decision support tools or these business intelligence tools. So you're right in your premise. We came together as a department without any unifying, overriding financial management system that ties the department together. So we have – in our department, we have, I think, 13 different financial systems. So you can make a major investment into keeping all those systems going and perhaps tying them together, or what we are going to do, which is we're going to do a very smart, needs-based assessment of the department financial management systems, those that are in greatest need of either replacement or repair, basically assessing the health of those systems. And we're going to systematically approach that. So we're going to go through component by component, financial system by financial system, and take a look at where we need, what kind of level of investment we need to bring these systems in line. For example, very simple thing. We don't have a common line of accounting. We don't have a cost accounting system. So it's very difficult. Imagine in the private sector trying to conduct your business without a cost accounting system, without being able to look at your costs commonly. You know, what do I spend for pencils? What am I spending for travel? What do I spend for training? Very easily, common across DHS. We don't have that ability right now. So this is probably the single most important thing that we're focused on right now, is building good financial management systems that will support the department. What also will this do? We haven't been able to get a clean audit, and it's very important that we do that. We've made tremendous progress. We've been able to get our material weaknesses down from about 10 down to 1. We've been able to get our findings down. Again, a lot of folks have put a lot of hard work into bringing the department forward. So I think we're right at the cusp of being able to seal the deal, if you will, on some of these initiatives. But being able to get an audit is driving us as well to improve our financial management system so that we can improve our reporting, so we can improve our internal controls over operations, our internal controls over financials, all the good fundamental core tools that we need to manage the department.
I understand your notion of you've got to be good first to move forward, but at the same time, there's a balance of, you know, what you bring in-house, what you acquire. I think we've talked about all these pieces independently, but I'd like to talk a little bit about how you're integrating that whole thing together. How are you coming up with, you know, the strategy for the balancing of the workforce and the contractor force so that you have ultimately the best possible delivery of the mission that you can have?
Well, we have an initiative that we call the Balanced Workforce Initiative that is designed to help us go precisely through that kind of analysis. Take any kind of contract. Take a look at the resource need and begin to assess, A, are we still meeting a core mission with this contractual activity? Have we achieved our mission? You know, when I, again, grew up in government in Florida, the state of Florida had something called sunset legislation. Good, bad, or indifferent, one thing that it did well was allowed us forced us to ask some of these questions. What's the useful life of this investment or this program or this initiative at the outset? So again, define an end state. So far too often, not just DHS, but far too often we find ourselves in situations where we enter into a contractual activity. We really don't have a clear sense of the end state. It's certainly no good for the agency, nor it is for the private sector partner. You know, everybody wants success. You know, when I was in the private sector, I wanted to get in, add value, and go away. Because the greatest endorsement I have of the work that we did was meeting my clients' objectives, not prolonging it, not prolonging the schedule, not exceeding cost. It was the greatest tool I had to win additional business, to be able to go to the next client and say that my track record is such that I was able to deliver to my client on time and on budget. That's all we're asking for, is an opportunity to be able to assess our workforce. Do we have the right mix? You know, the one thing that this is not is an attempt to go after contractors. Department of Homeland Security, many federal agencies, all the federal agencies use contract workforce to deliver services. We do that at the state and local level as well. The trick is to make sure that we have the right balance. As simple as, do we have the right people doing inherently governmental work, to what is the right mix of personnel for oversight? Do we have the right number of oversight for contract staff by federal government employees? All this tool does is allow us to evaluate these different factors and make a determination whether we're wisely spending our money. So it's important that our private sector partners understand this and know what we're going through. It's no different than what the private sector has gone through for the last several years as we've gone through a recession and companies were looking for ways to be more efficient, looking for ways to maximize the utilization of their resources. We're doing the same thing. You know, if there's one thing that I want to really keep harping on during my tenure at DHS is that we're entering a time of fiscal austerity. It's going to force us at DHS to be able to think differently about how we deliver services, at what cost, what our overhead structure is, what does it take to deliver those costs, and again, always thinking about, are we adding value back to the taxpayer? So a big part of my job, again, for the duration of my tenure, is to harp on, are we good stewards of the public's money? Are we managing our resources well?
How is DHS consolidating its physical footprint? We will ask Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can government cut costs and improve performance? How are disruptive innovations saving lives on the battlefield and expanding our presence in space? What is the U.S. Navy doing to strengthen its information dominance for the 21st century? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? And how are federal agencies leveraging technology to improve mission effectiveness? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. The Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine provides insights from those who lead. Hear from Richard Spires, leading Homeland Security's technology effort, Dr. Bobby Braun, advancing NASA's space technology program, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, strengthening the U.S. Navy's information dominance, and Sam Polcrano, coordinating U.S. Postal Service sustainability efforts. All of this and so much more in the Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Kruiser. Let's talk about the consolidation of the physical department with the DHS headquarters consolidation project. Would you tell us more about that? What are the benefits and operational efficiencies that will be realized from the move to a one physical infrastructure?
Well, there's so many areas that just make good sense about consolidating the department's headquarters. First of all, we're spread out at about 50 different locations within the National Capital Region here in Washington, D.C. So from efficiency standpoint, from a communication standpoint, from a collaboration standpoint, there are just so many inherent inefficiencies with that model. Now, we didn't get there by plan. Again, remember, this organization was put together by bringing together organizations that had their own locations or had their own leases outside of a physical headquarters location. And many of these are long-term leases. So this has to be staged very carefully. This is a managed process to bring these 50 locations together. And we were very fortunate to be able to have the campus, the West Campus of the St. Elizabeth's hospital site available for the Department of Homeland Security. So working with GSA to utilize that space, preserve the integrity, the historical nature of that campus, but also allow it to meet our operational needs is a wonderful activity which forces us to confront this one DHS. What are we? Is it simply being in one place? If that's all it was, that would be easy. Just move everybody into the same building. Does that guarantee success? Does that guarantee the one DHS? Of course not. It's not about the physical location. It's about the process we undertake to understand our mission, our interdependencies, and how do we use this new facility to reestablish, to sort of relocate and rethink about what does it mean now to staff the Department of Homeland Security? What does it mean for the way you provide human capital services? So if you have multiple entities going to St. Elizabeth's, for example, do they need multiple offices of human capital? Can we do that with fewer human capital offices serving the campus? Same thing with financial management or acquisition. So going through this exercise forces us to look at ourselves, see how we're structured, how we're organized. The physical part, the physical assets are just really the vehicle that is forcing us to address these issues.
What's the status of the project? And more particularly, I'd really like to tackle this part. What are some of the critical challenges you've faced in moving?
Well, any kind of physical relocation is a massive undertaking. You know, some of the biggest challenges initially, and again, many of my predecessors faced this, was establishing the rationale for doing this. I don't want to sort of diminish that. Making the case that this was important to bring the department together was made by some very good people, and they did a good job of it, and Congress has supported that. I have nothing but great respect and admiration for the hard work that was done to build a platform that said this is something that is a good investment of taxpayer money and we're going to fund this. And that's sort of step one. Secondly is coming to grips with, as I alluded to earlier, what is it – how are we going to use that space? And then how are we going to physically downsize, if you will, from 50 different locations into something substantially less? So you've got all the issues associated with different leases, staggered times, different cost structures, different overhead rates, and you've got to bring all of that together. This is a tremendous learning opportunity for the organization to learn how to do this. So in addition to the physical location, co-location, in addition to all of the efficiencies or synergies that we can develop, the discipline of going through this process is going to be very helpful. Now, how's the project going? You know, as a construction project, it's going very, very well. We're on time. We're on schedule right now. We continue to enjoy wonderful support from the Congress and from OMB that see great value in this project. Well, we expect to be done in around 2013, and it'll certainly take the better part of a year to physically move all of the people and all of the assets into the new Coast Guard building.
Well, you've mentioned before as one of your key challenges, well, actually two of your key challenges is acquisition and human capital. You've also touched on the fact that enhancing processes and structures or physical or centralizing a physical location is just not enough. You have to have the right people with the right expertise in the right job. So I want to sort of bring this all together and get a sense of, would you elaborate on your efforts to build a cadre of acquisition professionals at DHS?
First of all, I like the word acquisition because it's much more broad. It's much more broad and much more expansive than just procurement. Typically, when we talk about acquisition, a lot of people talk about acquisition. They mean procurement. We mean acquisition. So we're looking at just not contracting officers and contracting office technical representatives. We're talking about the whole human capital life cycle that supports acquisition. These are the project managers. These are the cost engineers. These are the schedulers. These are the systems engineers. This is the total asset inventory that's required to support a good acquisition. These are the good program executives that get an opportunity, have an opportunity to conjure up these good acquisitions, these strategies. It takes the whole life cycle. And we're putting our efforts. So we're looking at what are the right skill sets that we need? What is the right kind of training that's needed to grow the acquisition workforce? Acquisition right now is one of the hottest commodities in the workplace. It's the most, one of the most, if not the most competitive human capital field right now. It's very difficult. We're all chasing the same small assets. So we have to be very creative about growing our own. I'll use, you know, sort of the old axiom we use in local government about economic development. It's much cheaper to retain your existing base of local businesses than it is to attract new business. Now, you have to do both. But we always felt in local government from an economic development standpoint, It's going to be much cheaper, much more cost effective to make sure that you keep your existing business base in your respective city or town. Same thing with our talent. We want to invest in our people and we want to keep them in DHS. So that means they have to aspire to a grander vision. And talking about acquisition, putting them in the context of this large framework where they're in an end-to-end process and they're all colleagues in the same acquisitions cycle, if you will, is very, very important, very helpful for us to retain our existing workforce. We have to resource them. We've got to train them. We've got to give them the opportunity to grow. But again, what did I say at the outset? If they want to get better, they got to get good first. Mm-hmm. So we're going to push them to get really good at what they do. And doing so, I think we'll have a much better workforce.
Have you spearheaded any particular programs, professional programs for this area?
Well, we have a very extensive intern program, acquisition career intern program. I think to date we've had about 300 individuals go through that program. So that's a combination of internal DHS candidates and folks who have come from outside DHS, all disciplines. I meet with these groups periodically, and I'm amazed at the depth and the breadth of the skill sets these folks are bringing. Some of them are engineers. Some of them are political scientists. Some come from liberal arts. All different walks of life coming together involved in this acquisition career intern training program. It is building the future. So that's one that I would highlight, that we're making a tremendous investment.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Department of Homeland Security? We will ask Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at DHS, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. Also joining our conversation from IBM is George Cruiser.
You know, as you talked about the acquisition cycle and becoming more nimble in the upfront, I'd like to talk a little bit about the partnering and collaboration involved in really trying to drive technology, both the speed of technology that you get in and the innovation and driving innovation, and your thoughts around the strategies to use collaboration in order to drive innovation.
Well, we spend a lot of money on IT in the department, and we work with all of industry. Probably the first thing I'd say is very important to have a good open dialogue with industry. Industry needs to better understand our needs. We need to understand what we can expect in return. That kind of conversation is often difficult to have. There are all kinds of procurement regulations that govern how we can talk and where we can talk. But, you know, it's not impossible. You know, I've experienced some of this in the past. In my previous time in the federal government with GSA specifically, we had a quality partnership council where we worked very closely with the furniture industry. This was not a – you know, we didn't have procurement conversations. We talked about where the industry was going. We talked about where the federal workplace was evolving. What – think about it. This is late 90s. So a lot of work was being done. We were talking about different ways to work. We were talking about the use of different technologies back in the late 90s. How do we evolve the workplace to support the new worker, the knowledge worker? As the term was coined, I believe, back in the 1950s, but I can't remember his name, but it was a Harlan somebody or other who wrote a book on knowledge management. That forum provided us the opportunity to have these kinds of conversations, very big picture, very grandiose notions of where we were evolving as a workforce, as a workplace. So we were thinking already ahead of the mobile workplace. Modular workplaces, thinking about different kinds of the applications of different technology. You know, today in sort of the iPad world, we take for granted that you can just, you know, run to a coffee shop with your iPad and you can connect and you can be productive. We weren't quite there yet. We were still married to our desktops. Our laptops were still 9-10 pounders. But that's where we imagined the future. And that was the real powerful part of this Quality Partnership Council, where we really imagined the future of the workplace and how we wanted our workers to be more productive and what tools they were going to need and what that work environment needed to be. Well, same thing for technology. You know, we need to have a good, safe place where we can imagine the future. There are so many, you know, technology, the pace of technology is so rapid. It continues to be so rapid. I can't remember the exact statistic, but, you know, the amount of innovation that's taken place in the last 50 years probably exceeds the innovation that took place in all of mankind before that. There's some statistic like that. That's tough for any one person, let alone any one firm, let alone any one industry to keep up with. So we have to find good ways to have these conversations where, again, we're imagining the future, we're talking about innovation. But we have to do it holistically. We just can't do it with one sector or one part of industry, large businesses. You know, we're fond of saying that small businesses drive innovation in this country. So how do we find good ways to keep small business viable? How do we keep them engaged? How do we learn from them as well? How do we benefit from the partnership? Because there's many partnerships between large and small firms. How do we maintain that synergy? One of the things we're really proud of in the Department of Homeland Security is our ability to attract a good cross-section of business into the department. We have tremendous numbers when it comes to small business contracting. We have tremendous numbers when it comes to veteran-owned business contracting. We have tremendous numbers when it comes to women-owned business contracting. We're doing that in all why we're not sacrificing any of the $13 billion or so that we're spending on an annual basis. But how are we maximizing that relationship? And I'm not sure that we are yet. So we have to find better ways to dialogue and be able to learn from each other. I need to know industry's capabilities. Industry needs to know my requirements. And how do we bring that together so that we are better, again, I'm going to keep on using the same term, so I'm a better steward of the taxpayers' money.
Raphael, I'll close. My final question, I'll bring it back to the people itself. And, you know, as the mission to do a better and better job at securing the homeland, with that is an ever-changing skill set that's needed in order to really figure out the new threats and stop them before they hurt us. Talk a little bit about your thinking as you go into the future of what that workforce is going to look like as we evolve from a management, financial, human capital, technology perspective.
You know, we're seeing that in so many areas right now, whether it's the border and people much, much smarter than I am are spending good time thinking about what's the right mix of, you know, human capital assets and technology to secure our border. We're facing that at the airports every day with what's the right mix of human intervention with transportation security officers and machinery, whether they be imaging, whether they be the other screening devices. What's the right mix? What's the right way to secure our aviation security assets? Is it with more people? Is it with less people? Is it with more technology? Is it with behavioral detection? There are so many things going on right now, moving so fast, that we're taking our cues internally from our operators who are doing good research. They're working with our science and technology function within the department, again, to begin to ask these same questions. What is aviation security in 10 years from now? What is border security 10, 15 years from now? And what are going to be both the physical assets and the human assets that we're going to need to be able to support that? I didn't bring my crystal ball. I can't predict what that is right now, but we're going to follow that very, very closely and make sure that working with our other federal partners, with OPM and OMB and all the other stakeholders, that we're thinking about this, we're adequately planning for tomorrow's workforce. Whether it's going to be more resource intensive or less intensive, I can't tell you today. But this is among the most important questions that we have to face in our immediate future at Homeland Security.
Raphael, not to bring out the crystal ball again, but I want to keep us on that kind of idea of anticipation, maybe is the better word for it. How do you anticipate the future? And what are some of the opportunities and challenges you're anticipating as you lead the management directorate at DHS?
Well, I'll respond this way. Rather than talk about anticipate, what we're looking for is predictive tools. You know, I believe that we can develop diagnostic or predictive tools that look at the health of our programs, look at the health of our acquisitions, and give us a predictive insight into programs that are beginning to vector or veer off track. So I'm very, very interested in the predictive capability of our tools. It's far too late when a program shows up in breach, 30%, 40% over budget, or 30, 40% behind schedule, and we're in a reactive mode and we're trying to figure out how to bring that program back into alignment. I much rather be in the predictive or diagnostic mode of being able to assess on a periodic basis the health of programs and be able to then add value, because that's the real trick. It's one thing to sort of be the police officer for the good health of programs. But I really want to be in the I'm here to help you business. So if we can develop the predictive tools, and we're talking about these things, we're looking at prototypes right now. Concurrent with that, my responsibility is to find ways to help programs succeed. Again, it's a very different way to talk about it. I don't want to just play gotcha. I want to be able to catch you before you've gotten so ill that we can't help you. I want to catch you early, and then I want to help you get better. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. You know, some departments use a combination of what I would call a center of excellence model, where they co-locate, even virtually, certain kinds of expertise, skill sets, say cost estimating, for example. It could be anything. Many programs have a real deficiency in the skill sets that allow them to really do good cost estimating. What is this program going to cost me? Am I within my cost baseline? Am I veering off? That's a difficult skill set to maintain. We can do that virtually with a center of excellence within the department where you can, again, without physically co-locating people, but you can identify all your cost estimators, create a network. You can support them and train them so they can be a resource back to our organizational components. Those are ways to maximize our resources without creating a lot of new ones, because again, we're going to be entering a very, very difficult time, and the value proposition to create new resources, new billets, is going to be challenged. So how do I make best use of what we have right now in the department?
And to pick up on that, how do past accomplishments provide a guide for future success in your mind?
My notion is this. We're going to constantly evolve. We're going to continue to learn. And you can't be afraid to fail, but we do have to be much, much better about managing and mitigating risk. And that begins at the outset of identifying what is your risk profile. How risky is this venture? That's not a question we often ask in government, again, because we don't treat the dollars we spend the way I suggest we could as investments. So like with any other investment, what's my investment portfolio? How risky is it? How have I distributed those investments between high risk and low risk and medium risk? And those programs require different attention. Now, I'd like to think that we get so good and we get so smart that we would greatly minimize high risk investments, because we'll be able to mitigate them much earlier, even before we go forward with them. Again, if I look at some of the programs that have not succeeded, looking backwards, one could argue the way they were established, the risk profile was too high for the department. So we need to get much better at identifying our risk, mitigating it, or managing it. Part of the way we're going to get there is we want to have a better trained workforce. We've talked about the human capital needs. but I need to have the predictive and diagnostic tools that give us better insight into the health of programs as they're unfolding. I don't want to play gotcha.
So as our last question, I often ask my guests, what advice would you give someone who is interested in a career in public service?
It's the best career. People come into the public service for all kinds of different reasons. A lot of people ask me, why did I come back into public service? And I really answer it by, how could I not? How could I pass up an opportunity both to serve my country, to practice my craft, to do it in a place that arguably, to me anyway, has the most important mission of all the civilian agencies in the federal government? It's almost like a calling. It's so important. There are trade-offs between going into either the nonprofit, the for-profit, or the public sector. But I think it starts with wanting to do it. You know, I'm here because I want to do it. So I say to the young people quite often, in addition to, you know, if you want to get better, you got to get good first. I always say to them at the outset, you have to want to. You know, in Spanish we say, you have to have ganas. You have to have that desire. If you don't have it, you can't manufacture it.
Rafael, that's terrific advice. I want to thank you for joining us today. But more importantly, George and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the invitation to be here. I enjoyed it immensely.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Rafael Boris, Undersecretary for Management at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. My co-host from IBM has been George Cruiser. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
Listen next week for a special edition of the Business of Government Hour's Conversation with Author series, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness. What is open government, and how has the Open Government Directive sought to change the way government does business? Join host Michael Keegan as he discusses these questions and more with professors Guanhu Li and Young-Hoon Kwok, authors of the recent IBM Center report and Open Government Implementation Model, Moving to Increased Public Engagement. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
How can government cut costs and improve performance? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? How is the Navy strengthening its information dominance for the 21st century? What is the U.S. Postal Service doing to reduce its carbon footprint and green its operations? And how are state and local governments doing more with less? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. How can government cut costs and improve performance? How are disruptive innovations saving lives on the battlefield and expanding our presence in space? What is the U.S. Navy doing to strengthen its information dominance for the 21st century? What are federal agencies doing to be more transparent, participatory, and innovative? And how are federal agencies leveraging technology to improve mission effectiveness? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. The Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine provides insights from those who lead. Hear from Richard Spires, leading Homeland Security's technology effort, Dr. Bobby Braun, advancing NASA's space technology program, Vice Admiral Jack Dorsett, strengthening the U.S. Navy's information dominance, and Sam Polcrano, coordinating U.S. Postal Service sustainability efforts. All of this and so much more in the Fall-Winter 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual.